The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's stories include Downtown Eyes Comeback After Pandemic and Protest, and State Lawmakers Want More Oversight on Student Loans. From Sunday until Tuesday, John Pugh doesn't bother opening his downtown Raleigh clothing store, House of Swank. There are simply not enough people coming downtown to sustain a retail business every day of the week. "I can't justify it," said Pugh, whose business has sold humorous North Carolina-themed T-shirts for the past decade. But there hasn't been much humor to find in the situation in downtown since March 2020, where many businesses have struggled or closed altogether. The COVID-19 pandemic left offices empty and kept thousands of workers from buying lunches or shopping. Business travel slowed to a trickle, street festivals and concerts were canceled, and major conferences were placed on hold for months. And a year ago, what initially started as a peaceful protest over the death of George Floyd turned destructive, leaving nearly 200 businesses damaged or looted. The protest, first on May 30th and then again the next night, left the area on high alert, and businesses remained boarded up for months as nightly demonstrations continued into the summer. "This year was stressful," said Pugh. "We had to get custom boards made for our windows." Pugh, whose shop is on East Hargett Street, is one of the many business owners in downtown Raleigh who are cautiously waiting to see if the central part of the city recovers as vaccines become more easily accessible and coronavirus restrictions fall across the state. But it's still not clear when or if downtown will return to the heights of the past decade, when food and beverage sales in downtown broke records every year. According to one survey from the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, 42% of employees in downtown are not working in their offices, though many have eyed June as a potential soft reopening. While many business owners said they supported the Black Lives Matter cause behind the protest, even taking part in the peaceful demonstrations themselves, the prospect of more vandalism loomed, and the uncertainty added another layer of anxiety to an already tumultuous year. "It certainly was a very traumatic time," said Angela Salamanca, reflecting on last summer. She's the owner of the Mexican fusion restaurant Centro and cocktail bar Gallo Pilon on South Wilmington Street. Her hardships were magnified when her restaurant had its windows smashed during protests that she had participated in just hours before. "It was challenging," she said. "I mean, I myself was out there marching peacefully with my kids several times after the murder of Floyd. That didn't take away from my fear and my concerns as a business owner of getting our property damaged, and as a matter of fact, it was damaged." In the roughly 8 months that her restaurant's windows were boarded up, they featured a colorful mural that included a portrait of Floyd and spread the Black Lives Matter message. But inside the restaurant, the stress took a toll on more than just finances, Salamanca said, with morale being at an all-time low for her employees who came to work behind covered windows. "We're talking about how folks were feeling not safe to come to downtown to support businesses because everything looks like it's boarded up, in this very scary war zone-like place, she said. The boards created a perception problem for downtown, some business owners said. There is still a perception around safety, be it real or not, protest and COVID, Pew said. We are still getting consistent phone calls asking if it's safe. Over the last year, any reason essentially became a reason not to go downtown, adds Darwell Alohala, who co-owns Plaza Cafe on Fayetteville Street, a business whose main customers were office workers. Things are improving, however. On weekends, Moore Square has visitors again, and the nightlife in Glenwood South is almost back to pre-pandemic levels. Even during the heights of the pandemic, lines stretched outside night spots and bars on Glenwood Avenue. The district, home to some of Raleigh's most popular bars, is back to 89% of pre-pandemic sales, according to the research released in April by the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. But the recovery has been uneven so far, said Bill King, CEO and president of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. Parts downtown dominated by office buildings remain mainly empty, with employers not ready to send people back until later this summer, and even then probably on a hybrid schedule. The Fayetteville Street District, home to most of the city's tallest buildings, is only at 27% of pre-pandemic sales, according to the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. Let's face it, downtown has been a bit of a ghost town, Mayor Marianne Baldwin told the NNO in an interview. What we're seeing now is things starting to perk back up, so there's light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm optimistic. Baldwin said, as the Fayetteville Street corridor likely won't see a strong recovery until workers return in large numbers. Red Hat, for one, has plans for workers to return in September, with Citrix coming back in July. Though both of the companies and many others seem to favor keeping hybrid work in place for the foreseeable future. I think once you start seeing more foot traffic, you'll see more businesses open, said Baldwin, and it'll have this kind of spiral effect, so it's all going to have to work together, but that's what I'm excited about. The return of consistent events at the Raleigh Convention Center this summer and the Amped Up Music Series weekly live concerts at the Red Hat Amphitheater starting May 27th also will help, Baldwin said. The expansion of outdoor eating has been one bright spot, many say, and they're hopeful it stays in a post-pandemic world. That includes more restaurants with outdoor dining on sidewalks, plus a weekly rotation of Dine Out Downtown, which plunks tables down in the middle of the street in downtown's main districts. The Raleigh City Council recently approved an extension of outdoor dining through October 30th. Jennifer Martin, the executive director of Shop Local Raleigh, hopes the return of large events like the Brugaloo Beer Festival September 17th and 18th and the World of Bluegrass September 28th through October 3rd could provide a narrative shift for downtown. The Raleigh Staples were canceled last year along with other downtown festivals like SparkCon, Arts Closure, and the Hopscotch Music Festival, which typically draw thousands. Events create community and bring people back together, she said. Structurally, the recovery of Raleigh's retail and food restaurants might be related to one of its biggest strengths, its surging technology industry. According to research from Indeed, Raleigh is one of eight cities with large tech clusters, cities like San Francisco, Seattle, and Austin, where service jobs have recovered at a slower pace than the national average. While the tech sector has done just fine throughout the pandemic, others have not. Salamanca, the owner of Centro, for instance, said she has struggled to hire enough workers to fully open her restaurant on South Wilmington Street. What did much worse were local services and businesses that people weren't spending money at because they were working at home, said Jed Kolko, chief economist for Indeed. In places like these, big tech hubs where more people can work remotely, restaurants and retailers really suffered. Fewer people are getting lunch in the middle of the day. The businesses in San Francisco, Raleigh, Seattle, and Austin that fed and cut the hair and sold clothes to these workers saw their business drop. For some businesses, that meant closing for good. Apex Outfitters had its entire store looted and damaged extensively on May 30th during the first night of the George Floyd demonstrations. After navigating claims with its insurers and suppliers, owner Kyle Dennis said he was looking at spending $100,000 to simply open the door again. It was too great a price, he said, and Apex Outfitters officially closed its downtown Raleigh in December, shifting its resources to its original downtown Apex solution or location. Did I really want to put $100,000 back into something that for the foreseeable future, for the next 3 to 4 years, I'm not even going to break even on? He said in an interview. If the pandemic hadn't been ongoing and it was only getting worse last summer, the store potentially could have reopened successfully, he added. But the shop depended on employees from places like Pendo, Red Hat, and Citrix to shop there, and they aren't returning in droves to the office. Vincenzo Verdini, principal at commercial real estate agency CityPlat, said the double whammy of the pandemic and the aftermath of the protest made some companies cautious about leasing or investing in downtown Raleigh. If that's what your visuals are, it's hard to convince someone to invest in an office building or move to another location, Verdini said. It's not an inviting environment. But he said that perception came more from companies who would be new to Raleigh, those individuals that didn't have as much history in Raleigh, than those who have seen the capital city flourish in recent years. I think the individuals that have been invested in the city and have been to parts of downtown and have seen the growth that has happened, most of them have been and continue to be bullish on downtown Raleigh, he said. Dennis said he would love for his business to return to downtown Raleigh one day, though he said he has lost confidence in the leadership of the city. Downtown Raleigh will bounce back, he said, but it's going to take a while. Kolko said people are watching to see whether the pandemic has created a permanent shift in how people live, work, and shop. If workers permanently take on a hybrid schedule, catering demand could fall. Hotels could see fewer reservations for business travel. Conferences might become more sporadic. At the same time, we could see more demand for services in residential neighborhoods. If everyone is working at home, Kolko said, the restaurant lunch business might go down permanently in downtown, but might be higher in neighborhoods. Next, state lawmakers want more oversight on student loans. Imagine being 17 years old, your mom has died, and you are financially independent. Imagine what it would mean at that moment to have a university give you a scholarship to play basketball. Now, imagine all of that taken away after an injury. That's the story of 37-year-old Kenethia Rankin, who amassed around $70,000 in student loans after her injury cost her scholarship. She tried to dig her way out of the debt, but she was placed on a payment plan that she could not afford. I've been trying to establish a payment plan that I can pay monthly to pull out of this debt, and it's been impossible, Rankin said. Rankin is one of the 1.3 million people in North Carolina who have collectively borrowed $48 billion in student loans and are now making payments to try to repay that debt. Representatives Rachel Hunt, Democrat Charlotte, John Hardister, Republican Whitsitt, and Mitchell Setzer, Republican Catawba, are rallying behind these borrowers with House Bill 707, known as the Student Loan Borrowers Bill of Rights. It mirrors bills passed in 13 other states and Washington, D.C. Hunt, a college counselor, said that when students take on these loans at 17 and 18 years old, they're being handed documents with a bunch of promises about repayment options and loan forgiveness that are not being upheld on the other side of college. She said this bill is not intended to help people out of paying their debts, but to push for fair treatment of the borrowers. This bill isn't really going to do anything to reduce the amount of debt borrowers owe, said Rochelle Sparco, director of North Carolina Policy at the Durham-based Center for Responsible Lending. But it will make sure that they're in the best possible bargaining position to pay back that debt in a way that's affordable. Monthly payments on student loans can be as much as, if not more than, rent or mortgage payment, with as little wiggle room to have those numbers lowered. We need people to have the ability to have successful lives economically, Hunt said. It would help the state tremendously if they were treated in a way that they understood their responsibilities with these debts and knew how to pay them back in a truthful way, but they don't have that. If HB 707 becomes law, it would require the State Commissioner of Banks to license and regulate student loan providers, create a means for borrowers to complain about unfair lending practices, and allow both the borrower and the Attorney General's office to sue lenders who do not follow the state guidelines on lending. House members wanted to hold a hearing about the bill Thursday, but had to push it off by a week to finalize a new version that Hardister said would emphasize that the bill does not apply to banks. We're involved in the Bankers Association, and they're not against the bill, but they want to make sure that we get the language right, Hardister said. He added that banks are already heavily regulated, but non-banking institutions have no oversight. It's something that I don't think the General Assembly should ignore, Hardister said. I think we need to have some type of framework in place for oversight. Lawmakers said last month when they filed the bill that it is similar to what they did to offer residents relief from mortgage companies during the 2008 housing crisis. They said they hoped H. Bill 707 would free up borrowers' resources and help stimulate the economy. Hardister said there are too many stories of people who took out student loans, didn't get a job right away, or couldn't pay the amount required right out of college. He said the loan companies haven't been transparent about what happens when a person defers payments or goes into forbearance. He said those borrowers think they're being given a break, but they're not told about the consequences. That's what happened to Rankin. She has stories of trying to get loan payments lowered, deferred, or put off, and how it cost her. She's also answered letters saying her loans were eligible for forgiveness, but those lenders turned her down or turned out to look suspiciously like scams. Rankin said at some point she had to decide whether to keep a roof over her head or make her monthly payment. She ended up defaulting on her loan, affecting her credit score and then her ability to get a decent car and a house. Hunt said she has seen the way student loans and college tuition has hurt her students. Like Rankin, she's seen students lose their scholarships after a sports injury. And she says some students have put off working in the business they love or saving for retirement so they can pay back their loans. We know they cannot just resolve this through bankruptcy or any other way, Hunt said. It inhibits people's ability to live successfully. Hunt said her teenage students have no background in dealing with loans, and those who are the first generation to go to college or speak English as a second language are at more of a disadvantage in understanding how loans work than some of their peers. Sparko said that even when families understand the student loan's terms of service, providers are not fulfilling the promises they made when students left for college. They are not necessarily providing complete information or accurate information or working with borrowers to get them into the best repayment plans possible, Sparko said. Sparko added that some loan providers have treated the borrower so poorly that they've added billions of dollars in interest fees to student loan debt across the country. Instead of treating borrowers like customers, Sparko said lenders view the U.S. Department of Education as their customer. Sparko said the department gives out 85 to 90% of student loans nationwide and contracts with 30 to 40 companies. She said of those contract companies, around five have the majority of servicing obligations. It takes a lot of time and effort to put someone on an income-based repayment plan, Sparko said. So instead of giving that option, they defer the payments. Deferring payments increases the amount of interest a borrower accumulates and also negates their ability to have their debts forgiven if they didn't make enough money for the time set out in the terms of the loan. She said this includes those offered that incentive for working in public service. There's both anecdotal and data-driven analysis that these services are not giving people debt forgiveness when they're eligible for it, Sparko said. This leaves borrowers with two options, complaining to the Attorney General's office or the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But Sparko said those complaints rarely amount to anything. Scott Buchanan, executive director of the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, tells a different story and says before lawmakers find a solution, they need to get to the root of the problem. HB 707 requires a lender to pay fees to the state to be able to operate in North Carolina. He said those fees, along with attorney's fees to litigate the lawsuits that could be created under this bill, would eventually trickle down to the borrower, costing them even more. Buchanan said during the 2020, borrowers nationally made 98 legitimate complaints. He acknowledged that federal loan repayments were frozen during a portion of 2020 due to the pandemic. But Buchanan said over the past 4 years, complaints have decreased 70%. He said he works with student loan borrowers and finds the majority of their complaints are that they took on more loans than they could afford and didn't understand the repayment process at 18. He added that college tuition costs need to be reexamined and North Carolina lawmakers control that at state colleges. Buchanan isn't completely opposed to HB 707. Buchanan said borrowers face actual problems, and a portion of the bill calling for a state official to look into those complaints would benefit the state. He said lawmakers should gut the rest of the bill until they have real data and information and fix problems after learning what they are. Rankin has been working with Sparko to get help on her loans. I'm trying to get sorted out, Rankin said. I've been working with a financial counselor, and even with her help, it's been almost impossible just to climb out from under this debt. And it just seems like a bad nightmare that's never going to go away. She said she thought after losing her mother at 10 and trying to be financially independent at 17 that going to college and getting a degree would benefit her and move her life forward. I really don't think I would have attempted to get a college degree had I known that it would have this type of effect with other positive things that I'm trying to do, Rankin said. Rankin never finished college, but is now a manager at Starbucks, a company she says she loves and plans to retire from. She believes going back and finishing her business degree would be beneficial to both her and her company. And Starbucks does offer to pay for a bachelor's degree from Arizona State University. But she said after what she's been through with her student loan debt, she's too scared to try again. Next, PayPal wants to be far more than a checkout button. PayPal Holdings Incorporated is eyeing life beyond the checkout button. In the coming months, the firm is planning to debut a bevy of new services, which could include high-yield savings accounts, check cashing services, and stock investing capabilities. It's all being done in the hopes of PayPal becoming the world's next super app, akin to China's Alipay or WeChat, India's Paytm, or Singapore's Grab. The stakes are high. If PayPal pulls it off, the company could become a bigger part of U.S. consumers' lives than Amazon, Google, or Facebook. But in the U.S., there is no shortage of banking giants and technology firms that have tried and failed to accomplish what PayPal wants to do. It's difficult to become a super app, PayPal Chief Executive Officer Dan Schulman said in an interview. I think we have a chance if we execute extremely well against this, but it's obviously a place that a lot of companies are thinking about as well. He ordered his team to begin conducting consumer research. PayPal is planning to debut the new services in the third quarter. The company is now processing more than $1 trillion in payments on its platform annually and is adding as many as 55 million new users this year on top of the 377 million it already had. It's all a far cry from where PayPal started when it went public under Schulman's leadership 6 years ago. Since then, the company's valuation has soared to roughly $300 billion, more than Citigroup, Inc. and Goldman Sachs Group combined. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.